Funding for Roots, Race, and Culture is provided in part by the Norman C. and Barbara L. Tanner Charitable Support Trust and by donations to PBS Utah from listeners like you. Thank you.
Hey, my friends, you're listening to Roots, Race, and Culture, the podcast from PBS Utah.
If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe, leave us a review, and share with your friends.
All right, now let's get this thing started.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Roots, Race, and Culture, where we bring you into candid conversations about shared cultural experiences. I'm Lonzo Liggins.
And I'm Daner Gerald. Well, it's election season, and regardless of which side of the political fence you prefer, no one can argue the fact that it's a controversial and historic presidential race. In some ways, a vote never meant so much to the country.
That's absolutely right. And joining us today in the studio, we have two guests who have very intimate experiences and critical appreciation for what it means to have the right to vote. First, we have Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Loki Mulholland. He's the director of 10 films, including Dying to Vote, After Selma, one of my personal favorites, The Uncomfortable Truth, and The Evers. Loki, would you please tell us about yourself?
Oh, thank you for having us. Yeah, Loki Mulholland. My simple introduction is I'm Joan's son, the civil rights icon sitting across from me at the moment. And, I've done documentary cinema for probably 20 years now. And majority of my films have actually been produced in Utah, but they focus on issues ranging from civil rights to social justice to voter suppression and the like.
Yeah, they're amazing films too. I've watched almost pretty much all of them. They're incredible.
Also, we have joining us a civil rights icon, as you said, a legendary person in our country's history, Joan Trumpauer Mulholland, Loki's mother. Thank you so much for joining us, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And, I really don't have adequate language to describe what you mean to me personally. And also to the country for all of the work that you did fighting for everyone having the right to vote. So we have a clip that we have from Loki's movie, An Ordinary Hero, where we can introduce you properly. So let's take a look at that.
There was one sit-in that almost duplicated the Jackson sit-in.
And this was not that long after World War II, so Nazi armbands and brown shirts and lunging police dogs. The whole thing was frightening.
Within a couple of weeks, the drug stores in Northern Virginia desegregated, and my mother and her companions began looking for their next target. They settled on Glen Echo Park in Maryland with its segregated swimming pools and amusement rides. My mother purchased the tickets as her fellow black students rushed to get a seat on the merry-go-round. Because, as she would later say, there's the back of a bus and a back of a line, but there's not a back of a carousel. In all, my mother would participate in nearly 36 sit-ins and protests before a seemingly peaceful plan was hatched to confront interstate travel. It would be called the Freedom Rides. And so at 19 years old, my mother and her friends were sent to the most dreaded prison in America, Parchman.
Probably one of the most violent and worst places a human being could be.
Oh yeah, here's 14, home sweet home.
To see the cell was as small as I remembered it. Not comparable to the Nelson Mandela's experience, but a cell that was smaller than the one he was in for years, we had up to 4 people in. And that did put it and, that part of it in perspective.
Wow, that's an introduction indeed. That is an incredible story. And I'm so excited to hear more, not only about your documentaries, but about your story, because, I've done a ton of research about you. I know Loki as well. And it's just incredible what you went through at that time. And I think the first question I have for both of you is, you've traveled around the world, both of you have. You've seen all sorts of places. What is it about being an American that means so much to both of you? Let me start with you, Joan.
Well, we have a reputation in the world for better and worse. And I'm really sort of indifferent to whether I'm an American or a Canadian or what have you. Mm-hmm. One of the Western countries. We're all good.
That's really cool. And so for you, it's about the people more than it is about the country. Is that what it is? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Loki?
Well, yeah, we represent an ideal. I mean, the ideas of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that we're all created equal, was a pretty profound statement to make. And it's something that other countries have tried to emulate, and it's something we've tried to project throughout, despite our history of not making everything equal. But we've worked towards that, and people like my mother and her friends, particularly during the civil rights movement, we're doing that. You know, at the end of the day, though, it's you know, God created people, not borders.
Right. That's right. People made the borders, right?
Right.
That's true.
And you know, and we are, you know, this is the human race, and you know, this is a really small little marble we're sitting on in this vast universe, and we need each other to survive, right? And I think the great experiment that we are is part of that can show that we really can make this work.
I'm watching the videos, you know, and I'm seeing you going through some of these ridiculously dangerous parts of the South. What inspired you to want to go and get involved in some of these sit-ins and be involved in a movement where at that time, especially with the Klan and especially with the temperature of the country, the racial tension, you could get murdered. People were getting murdered down in the South.
I had friends who were murdered, yeah.
You were almost murdered yourself.
Yeah, I came close to dying in it a time or two. I think it's my Sunday school lessons about loving your neighbor as yourself and treating people the way you want to be treated that really put me into it.
So when you have a country that, you know, in its, you know, motto, it says that all men are created equal, right? Like, it's constitutional, right? So how do you settle with those two conflicting ideas when, you know, all men are created equal, yet we're not treating each other equal? Is that really kind of when you have to decide, what am I going to do about this or what?
I think so. I mean, those statements in the Constitution are a goal. For me, but we got to achieve that goal. We got to work at it.
Was it rare for people to come out and, you know, especially white people at the time, to come out and protest like that? Or was that an anomaly for you to go out there and have those sit-ins? Because you were young. You were in your teens, correct?
Yeah, I was a teenager. Well, you know, teenagers get a little crazy sometimes. But in the South, it was really just unheard of for a white Southerner, particularly a woman, to get out there and do something. But I think it was perhaps a little more demonstrations and protests were a little more common or what have you in the North with the unions and all. But
well, you know, this need to fight Jim Crow and everything and segregation, that's a pretty good motivator if your heart's in the right place and like you said, Sunday school is your motivation. But then we think about the other things that they were fighting for, which, you know, this show is about voting. So you had a pretty close run-in with the Klan that Loki talks about in the film. This is right before Freedom Summer. So let's take a look at that. And we'd like to hear some thoughts from you about that, Loki.
We had no doubt we were going to die. Mississippi was known as the deepest of the deep South, the heart of darkness, where lynchings were not considered a crime. We had known all along that somebody was going to die that summer, and it looked like it was us.
There was a curfew, and there had been heavy demonstrations over the right to vote. Earlier in the day at the courthouse, several hundred people marching there, and a lot of people had been beaten. Throughout the day, there had been incidents of whites just attacking blacks walking on the streets. So a very violent atmosphere. And I said, we know you can kill Americans. That's all right with the FBI and the government. But the government and the FBI won't let you kill a foreigner. That'll hurt our reputation throughout the world. The communists would make a lot out of it. They began to say, literally, at the back, let's have a party, let's have a party, which meant a lynching party. And others were saying, we've got to do it tonight because this is our way to stop Freedom Summer. You know, to kill a bunch of people in advance.
From the time they were missing, we knew they were dead.
We were supposed to have been killed that night to stop Freedom Summer. And because we weren't killed, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman hits home real hard.
Yeah, that is a powerful time. I remember those three guys that happened to. What are your thoughts, you know, about, in particular, you know, I was watching this gentleman on Instagram. His name was Ernest Krim III.
Yeah.
He was talking about, he made a statement where he said, name five white people in American history who fought against racism and slavery. And he said, and you know, the audience was silent. No one was able to say anything. And then he said, were there five? And he said, you know what, there were thousands. There were thousands of white people. And he said, why can't you name them? Mm. You know, it's, and he said, you know, there's people like Bruce Clunder and Ann McCarty Brady, Reverend James Reeb, John Brown, and then the people that were in that clip. Can you talk about the relevance of and the amount of white people that are actually involved in the civil rights movement and why we don't hear about them today?
Well, it's portrayed basically as a black movement. Mm-hmm. And whites aren't black. So we just sort of wiped out of the picture. And, but there were lots of them.
Right.
And people raising money for the people who were doing the work in the South and inviting us to speak. And yeah.
Well, I think one of the critical things to understand in regards to Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner in particular is there were actually several black people killed prior to them, you know, just weeks prior, never got any press. Mm-hmm. It was only when whites would get attacked, when mm-hmm. whites would be killed, that suddenly America was like, wait a second, this is something we got to talk about. And particularly because they were Northerners coming down to the South, mm-hmm. that national press was there, their congressmen and so forth were making noise about it. You know, America was okay with blacks being lynched, mm-hmm. You know, and being beaten. It was the exposure really didn't happen in particular until whites could see whites being attacked and killed. Now suddenly it becomes, well, we got to wake up. I mean, that's what President Johnson with voting rights and the Voting Rights Bill. Mm. You know, when Viola Liuzzo gets killed and stuff, suddenly we got to start talking about this. This is important.
And you know, you mentioned the Voting Rights Bill, and this is the thing. Like, a lot of people don't, they think of the voting season as just like a vote for the president, right? And if you're not really happy with either candidate, you know, historically it's always been either a Republican or a Democrat that's won, right? So what do you do if you don't see any major party candidate that you like? How do you motivate people to exercise this right to vote that you know, talk about in your films and that you fought for? Like, what do you do?
Well, I think one of the problems we have is we focus too much on the presidential side of things. And the real impact of our votes is really on the local. Mm. And so when people don't show up for the presidential elections, that means everyone down ticket in the local aspects aren't getting voted on. So we have to be willing to come in and vote regardless if we like the candidates or not, because there are all those local candidates we got to make sure that we're doing, you know, justice for. In particular, because everything's local. The real impact of our votes is the local aspect of things.
You know, that's a good point, because the real impact of what was happening down South was the local people, right? If the president is trying to pass some law about, you know, the right to vote for everyone, but yet you have lynchings and things, that's the local electorate that's right. making that problem.
Well, and look, I mean, 1965 is the Voting Rights Act, mm. right? Mm-hmm. Vernon Dahmer was killed after that because he was trying to register African Americans to vote. So just wow. because the Voting Rights Act happened and everyone could now vote doesn't mean the Klan and others weren't, you know, still accepting of this idea. Remember, Brown versus Board was 54. Mm. Segregation mm-hmm. still exists.
Was that right. a primary part of what you were doing in the South, or, you know, with a lot of these sit-ins? Was it primarily about voting, or was it about civil rights?
Other aspects or what?
Well, we had focuses, you know, like on lunch counters.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were sitting at the lunch counters kept the freedom rides going. Mm-hmm. This had to do with interstate travel, which the Supreme Court had just ruled on that everything had to be open. And so the sit-in students kept the freedom rides going when the buses were burned and things. And then when some of those freedom riders got out of jail, the sit-in students, they got involved in the local communities and realized if you're going to make a difference, you got to be able to vote for the people that make and enforce the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became the focus. And some of the same guys, mostly guys, then moved from Mississippi over to Alabama. And that led to the march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge,
mm-hmm.
where the beatings were so bad that President Lyndon Johnson, himself a powerful Southern Democrat, only chosen as Kennedy's running mate because he was a powerful Southern Democrat, went on national TV before a joint session of Congress, when that was almost a first, and described in detail the beatings on the Edmund Pettus Bridge,
mm-hmm.
and said, we must have a voting rights law, and we shall overcome. And he repeated, we shall overcome, mm-hmm. the anthem of the civil rights movement. And it was those three words were the death knell of the Southern Democratic Party, which had made him president.
Wow.
And we got the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, and then you take that to today, like, because I was just watching Dying to Vote the other night, which is one of your documentaries, and we look at the stuff that was happening back then, and then we look at what's happening now. There are still issues when it comes to voting.
Yeah.
There are definitely issues around the country today when it comes to voting. Can you speak a little bit about some of those issues?
Yeah. So, I mean, the issues that we have today, in particular, is voter suppression. So these are laws and things that are created to make it as hard as possible to allow the individuals to vote. You can't keep them from voting per se, but we're going to put so many barriers in front of them that we're going to frustrate them to the point where they don't even want to vote. Mm-hmm. One of those great things is the voter ID, because there's this whole theory that, you know, that there's all this massive voter fraud. Statistically, you have a better chance of being struck by lightning while being attacked by a shark than actually voter fraud taking place.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, for example, I'll give you a great example. So in our film After Selma, we talk about Alabama. So in Alabama, they decided, well, you need to have an ID, and to get that ID, you have to go to the DMV. So then what they did was they restricted the hours that the DMV was open to just working hours. Well, the majority of the people, particularly African Americans, were working hourly jobs, so they couldn't actually get to the DMV because if you work hourly, you need that money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, then what they decided to do was, because people were actually finding ways to do it, they then ended up closing all the DMVs in black neighborhoods. This is fact.
Mm.
This is what they did. They closed that to further frustrate it, because now as a black person, you had to go to the white neighborhood, which generationally, you were told, don't go there, and you weren't wanted there, to go to that DMV to get the voter ID.
So get people as far out of their comfort zone as possible.
As far as out of their comfort zone possible. Not, you know, again, it's to create the barriers. Mm. And in Georgia, what were they doing? I mean, they're like, you can't give people water, you know, in
right.
line.
Let's
watch a clip from the movie, because this is a great film, and we have a clip from it, so let's check it out.
To millions of Americans, the long-fought battle for voting rights culminated on Bloody Sunday, when 600 courageous marchers were attacked by police on horseback as tear gas and screams filled the air. Selma, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, forever ingrained in American history, monuments to a struggle. Everyone can now vote. So what happened? Following the Civil War, the 15th Amendment prohibited the barring of anyone from the right to vote based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude. To get around that, states used societally imposed conditions, instead of race, as the litmus test to vote. The poll tax and literacy test. Newly freed African Americans had no money, and only 3% could read or write. And if that didn't work, then there was always the tools of terror. But voter ID would only be one of many levers which a party could pull to suppress the vote and change the results. Combined with voter purging, mass incarceration, gerrymandering, and the closing and moving of polling locations, this lethal cocktail would alter our democracy.
Felony disfranchisement has a long, sordid history. Alabama, in its Jim Crow Constitution of 1901, crafted a language in there that said, if you have been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, you have lost your right to vote. Alabama refused to define moral turpitude. And so you have a conviction, but you don't quite know if it's moral turpitude or not. Are you going to risk voting and getting hit with another felony because you decided to vote?
Wow. So, I mean, the frustration is clear with people there. And, you know, I'm kind of curious because both of you have spent a lot of time with these civil rights activists from back in the day. How do they feel about the current state of the democratic process and this, you know, when they're seeing that these things that they fought so hard for are still being frustrated?
Well, as the saying goes, we've come a mighty long way, but we still got a mighty long way to go.
They're still in the fight.
Yeah, I mean, the one refrain I hear lately is, this is just a reminder that the civil rights movement never ended, because there's still civil rights issues.
There's still work to be done.
Still work to be done.
And you are both actively still working on things. I understand you guys speak a lot, you show your films, that kind of thing. So, You're keeping your mother very busy.
Free trips.
Yeah. You guys are both like, when I think of, you know, white allies when it comes to the civil rights movement and when it comes to, you know, black struggles and things of that, you two come to mind immediately. And it just makes me wonder why, you know, like as I was saying before, why do you think that a lot of this, the history of some of the, you know, struggles that whites have went through to help black people isn't spoken about enough?
Well, I think if it was spoken about more whites would be more engaged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're at a point again in history where we have people that want to divide people, right? And representation's important. It goes both ways. Right. And that's the power of my mother's story, is this white Southern woman who saw something was wrong and decided to do something about it and chose the courage of her convictions, and that we all can do that.
Mm-hmm. That's hard to do. Yeah. And to try and teach that is hard. So I have a question for you. When you speak to young people, how do you express the importance of protecting people's civil rights and the right to vote for everyone, to give them that same courage of their own convictions? How do you express that to younger people?
Oh my.
Is that a big can of worms I just opened up?
But if you don't vote, you don't count, as my daddy always said. And so we've got to do everything we can to protect the right to vote, so we all count.
Yeah, you know, when I look back at some of those clips of you going through some of that hatred that you received, was there a lot of hate directed towards you at the time when you were, you know, involved with some of those sit-ins and some of those registrations?
I was considered a traitor to the race, going against the way things, you know, white folks should have things. Mm-hmm.
Top 10.
She was on the Klan's most wanted list.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. She was on the Klan's most wanted list.
They had a poster, just like the FBI had a poster, the 10 most wanted. And if you got killed, they X'd your face out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Medgar Evers, all, they got X'd out. I never got X'd out, but I was close a time or two. Wow.
Well, we have a clip of the film that I was just discussing, Dying to Vote, and it tells the story of the Dahmer family.
Right.
And they lost their father in the early 60s because he tried to exercise the right to vote. So let's go ahead and take a look at that clip, because this is a really great film.
About 2 o'clock in the morning on January the 10th, 1966, my family was attacked by two carloads of armed Klansmen, because they wanted to send a message a message of fear and intimidation to the black community about what could happen to you if you decided you just wanted to try and register to vote. Not vote, but just try and register.
I've been here at the Capitol. I've seen demonstrations on a regular basis, and never in my wildest dreams did I believe that someone would be crazy enough to break into the United States Capitol, but they did.
November 10th, 1898, Wilmington, North Carolina, and the only successful coup attempt to ever take place on American soil. Three of the city's 10 aldermen are black. To end this Negro domination, former Confederate Colonel Alfred Waddell threatens to choke the Cape Fear River with carcasses. On election day, red shirts patrol black neighborhoods, but blacks continue to vote and hold office. Waddell, with his mob of over 2,000 men, convenes at the courthouse where he delivers the White Declaration of Independence. We, the undersigned citizens, do hereby declare that we will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin. The angry mob rampages through the black neighborhoods with rifles and a Gatling gun. Some 250 African Americans are killed. The aldermen are thrown out and Waddell is declared the new mayor. Black elected officials are jailed and marched to the train station. Thousands more flee. 2 years later, the North Carolina legislature would enact strict Jim Crow laws.
Mm. Whew. So, yeah. Wow.
That's deep.
That's deep.
Choke the Cape River with carcasses.
Yeah, the fear-mongering.
It's fear-mongering. And you know, this Damer family lives close to Hattiesburg. I have roots there, right? And so, for me, there's something important about connecting that past, which for young people feels like ancient history. You know, they're thinking this was forever ago, but, you know, there's these pictures, but here we are, right? And so how do you connect that idea of sacrificing your life, which, you know, their father did to help register people to vote after the Voting Rights Act was passed? How do you connect that past to the present? And there's a little bit of it in there with Benny Thompson, but what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, that's part of the challenge is, you know, we look at the past, we see these black and white photographs and we're going, well, that was then, this is now. We don't see that taking place anymore in regards to the Klan riding around and doing that per se. And unless you live in, you know, in Tennessee where white supremacists were marching down the street just recently.
Wow.
But we have to be able to bring them to the present and see the issues that exist today and what's taking place in regards of particularly voter suppression. Mm. And the intimidation is still there, still real. I mean, I believe it was the 2020 election wherein in Arizona you had folks out there with guns, you know, monitoring things.
Wow.
So those sort of things still take place. But really, it's really about connecting the issues that impact them the most and understanding that your vote matters. That they're trying everything so hard to take away your vote or suppress that vote. That's how important your vote is. Every vote matters.
Yeah, and January 6th, I mean, they were trying to essentially turn over the election, this attack on, you know, the Capitol, and people died.
Yeah.
And they were essentially trying to protect the integrity of
police
the process. The police officers who died were trying to protect the integrity of the voting process.
The presidency. You know, my question is, we have, you know, there's a saying that we often hear that's, you know, we learn from the past and we can take that into the present. What was it that people were so afraid of black people getting the vote back in the 1950s and 60s? Why were people so afraid? What did they feel was going to happen if black people had the vote?
Well, they felt that blacks were inferior to them. They weren't as intelligent. They weren't as moral. And that, you know, chaos would come out of that. And also, they were sort of afraid of revenge, that blacks would do do unto the white people as the white people had done unto the black people. Mm-hmm. So
so that fear was something that they had inside of them, sort of like a fear of retribution, so
yes.
to speak.
Is that the fear? Do you think that fear carries over to today?
Well, yeah. I mean, so back then, and the same rhetoric is used today. So back then in particular, like if we look at Brown versus Board, we look at Bloody Sunday, the book from Judge Brady, which led to the lynching, basically led to the lynching of Emmett Till, started that up was miscegenation, right? That we're going to lose the white population. So today we have the same theory of what's called the Great Replacement Theory, mm-hmm. which is whites are going to disappear. Now, I hate to break it to whites, but whites are already a minority in the world, always have been a minority in the world. So I don't know what we're being.
And we're all out of Africa.
We're all out of Africa, anyways, right? But I don't know how we're going to be replaced because it's weird to even talk about. But it's the fear, and fear works so well. Mm-hmm. It's an effective tool that continues to be drawn back out year after year. And we go, well, why do people keep believing it? Well, because it keeps working.
Well, speaking of fear, let's take a look at some of the fear tactics that were used back then when you were, again, involved in some of these sit-ins at Woolworth. If we could show that clip.
When Salter joined, the crowd turned violent. He was knocked in the back of his head with brass knuckles. There was a student who put his cigarette out on the back of Salter's neck. There were several cigarette, and you can still see it to this day. If you look on the back of his neck, he has scars in the shape of a cigarette. They threw pepper and water mixture into his eyes.
My guideline was, don't let the sons of bitches see you suffer.
Things were just going out of control. And at that point, Joan has said that she believed that they were not going to make it out alive. None of them were going to make it out alive.
I think I was beyond fear. I think I was driven by determination to carry this through. And by the time I sat at the counter a while, it was like an out-of-body experience that the real me had left the body, and it was just a shell there. And the real me was sort of up above, like a guardian angel, letting me know what was happening and protecting me to some extent. But the real essence of me, the important part, was already.
So after nearly 3 hours of this intensity, at a little after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the manager comes down, turns out all the lights in the store, and tells everybody to leave.
Those are iconic images, but and to us it's just a photo, but to you it's your life. What do you feel when you go back and see those things?
Ah, I got a little place in history.
Yes, you do. Yeah. And
do you feel like it was worth it?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, but those kids were a product of their environment. That the schools were segregated, the churches, the law, everything said segregation was the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And we were violating that.
So you're sort of blaming the environment versus the people who were, this is a little bit of they know not what they do, I'm hearing.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Wow, that is.
But there had to have been a peer pressure.
Yeah, well, and this comes back to your point about, education. How do people not know these things? Well, in the absence of speaking the truth, this is what's gonna happen. So creating a society wherein people are separated, not educating individuals about history, about culture, and so forth, about the power of the diversity of our nation, right? Mm-hmm. This is what's going to happen, and it clearly plays out that way. And we see those echoes today, wherein people will go into churches and shoot them up, or synagogues, and so mm-hmm. forth. Mm-hmm. Have language that says that people coming over the border are rapists and murderers and just the worst people in the world. I mean, it's like it's the rhetoric that feeds into this, that continues to perpetuate this mythology. Mm-hmm. It just isn't really there.
Yeah, you were going to say something?
Well, the textbooks that you had in school on history and all, I mean, even in elementary school on up through high school, they said that the slaves were well-treated and happy.
Right.
What was it recently? Someone said, oh, this, it was like on-job training. It was
right, right.
We taught them some good skills so that they could, you know, employ themselves.
I know, because I watched that clip, and I watch what you went through. You know, a couple things come to my mind. You know, first of all, like, obviously when people do say, you know, well, back then, that's just kind of how people thought. That wasn't how you thought. And there's a lot of people like you that were throughout history who didn't think that way and who kind of stood their ground and said, this is obviously wrong, you know? When you were a part of that whole situation, was there a big palpable fear that you had, like that you were a part of something wrong, or did you question whether or not you were doing the right thing?
I didn't question it one bit, and I'd say never give way to fear. It'll paralyze your brain and keep you from thinking what you should be doing in the situation. Fear will get you killed.
Wow. Wow. I mean, we don't really have time particularly to go into some of the details of some of the people. I mean, I got the pleasure of working on that movie with Loki. And I mean, people who were roaming around the campus where you were at, Tougaloo College, an HBCU down in Mississippi. We're talking Bob Dylan, we're talking
Dr. King.
Medgar Evers. I mean, we're talking some of the most, like,
Joan Baez. Gave a concert out there.
Yeah, what are the famous actors?
Marlon Brando. Oh, yeah, well, hit on you, right?
Yeah.
Well.
Really? Is that right?
Hey, I'm not surprised, because let's take a look at this last clip, because there's a beautiful image of Joan, her mugshot, if you will. Let's take a look at this last clip.
I'm standing on the path that I walked down with Dr. King after he spoke here, to take him over to the science building where he was speaking to a crowd.
Through the summer of 1963, my mother stayed in D.C. and focused her energies on helping plan and organize one of the largest human rights rallies in U.S. history, the March on Washington.
Up until the march actually took place, till that morning, we were not at all certain it was going to come off. The newspapers had brought up the possibility of riots. Store owners downtown boarded up storefronts a bit, or anticipating problems. The American Nazi Party was just over across the river in Arlington. A lot of people were against the civil rights movement then. And there was even thought that the federal government might bring out troops and prevent the march from happening, that the buses would be halted before they even got to the city. It's not just one person that does it all. It's not just Dr. King, it's not just Rosa Parks, it's not just Harriet Tubman, the way it's taught in school. But that it's lots of people that you've never heard of doing what's right, going beyond themselves and out of their comfort zone, making hard choices that causes change. I saw something was wrong and wanted to try to help make it right. We have to pick our targets. And mine was the Southern way of life.
I love that.
That's the most beautiful mugshot in the history of the world.
that is a great mugshot, actually. You know, I'd love to talk about the foundation that both of you work in. It's the JTW Foundation.
Yeah, the Joan Trump Power Mulholland.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, the Joan Trump Power Mulholland Foundation, named after my mother. You know, created it to preserve, share, and continue my mother's legacy while teaching others about the civil rights movement and how they can make a difference. It all came out of that film and a screening we did at Ole Miss, where we had college-educated kids come up to us and say, "We never learned any of this. Mm-hmm. Like, how is this possible?" Right. And so that became the journey, and we've done all these documentaries, you know, multiple books and, you know, training modules and things like that. In particular, right now, one of our key focuses is our HBCU micro scholarship program that we have, And again, this is just to kind of continue the work that my mother and her friends started.
That's awesome.
That's good. Thank you for that work. I mean, the activism continues. It's a family tradition. I think it's clear that in this family, they like to stir up the status quo.
Getting good trouble.
Getting good trouble. So let me ask you a question, Joan. How do you feel about people who kind of feel powerless in this political climate? Like, what could you tell them to inspire them, to encourage them, based on your amazing history?
Well, you can make a difference in that you got to pick your topic, you got to get together with friends who agree with you, get a plan of action, and get out there and do something. And remember the power of the press. You take your issue to the street or the lunch counter, the lawyers take it to the court, all the way to the Supreme Court, but the press takes your issue to the world. Mm. And when stuff starts flying, they're in as much danger as you are.
Yeah.
So honor the press and rely on them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
I have one question for you, Loki, because you've made this beautiful span of work. You have a large presence online, very much an ally to the community. What would you say to a person that was watching, let's say a white person, who say, you know, I'm interested in getting involved in learning the history of African Americans and learning our history of what we did in the civil rights movement?
Right.
What would you say to a person like that about, you know, potentially being a better ally or getting involved?
Well, what I always tell people is show up and shut up, first and foremost, right? The people, wherever they are doing the work that they're doing, don't need you to come in and try to tell them how to solve their problems. They already know what the problems are. They just need support. Mm-hmm. And second is, you know, I used to beat myself up, you know, going, man, I'm not doing what my mother did, or, you know, or John or Hank Thomas or others. You know, it's like, well, no, I don't have to. My mother once said something that's really profound to me is, I can't do everything, but I can do something, because doing nothing is not an option. Mm-hmm. And we just need to find, like my mother said, find what's important to us and do that. Now, I've taken the gifts that I've been given, that I've been blessed with, to make films and tell these stories and so forth, and that's my work. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to have their thing that they can do. In the civil rights movement, not everyone was on the front line. Dana, your mother or your grandmother hosted folks from Freedom Summer, right? That was what they could do. That might sound trivial, just hosting someone in your house. But when you're hosting a white person in your house in Mississippi in 1964, that's a target. Mm. So the bravery that takes place.
The Klan burned crosses in front of that house because of it.
Right. But we all can do something. Mm-hmm. And in the civil rights movement, some folks, again, you know, were cooking meals, providing transportation, getting bond money together. All those things add up.
There were as many people on the front lines as there were people having their back. It was about equal number. People having your back, doing things to make it possible, and you out on the front lines.
Yeah. So just make sure you're doing something.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
and today, voting too is like a really powerful part of doing that something.
That is something.
Yeah. Absolutely, and that actually brings me to our conclusion. You know, it may seem like Joan and Loki's activism and the value of a vote are two very different topics.
Now, we're not ancient history.
No, not at all. You're right here. But many people, you know, may feel like they'd never be able to do one thing in their life that's as meaningful as these two activists have done. But my message and our message to you is that each and every time you register and you vote, you are being an activist. Your vote says to America that you also matter, that you count, and you have the right to be seen and counted in guiding our democracy.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Roots, Race, and Culture.
Check out our website for more content, information about our guests, and other episodes. You can find all that in a bag of chips at pbsutah.org/roots.
And you'd be doing us a solid if you told all your friends about our show. But until next time, y'all, we are out.